Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall in London. Susie Klein with you live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales under their principal conductor, Thierry Fisher. And next for you on the musical menu, well, the table is laid, but not necessarily with anything you'd want to eat. A Table of Noises is a percussion concerto by the orchestra's composer in association, Simon Holt. It was written for tonight's soloist, Colin Currie. First heard a couple of years ago when it was commissioned by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And tonight, A Table of Noises receives its London premiere. The title of the work was inspired by Simon Holt's great-uncle, Ashworth Hutton, who was a taxidermist. Well, Ashworth was severely crippled, so he needed the tools of his trade close to hand. His parlour table became the home for the various things he needed, and it's this object that gave the concerto its title. The music is in 10 movements. Some of them refer to Ash's macabre business, so there's some creepy names here. A drawer full of eyes and under glass, for example. There are also sections where the soloist is entirely absent. Instead, the music's inhabited by spectral figures, what Simon Holt calls ghosts, and these ghosts make visits throughout the piece. Well, the work's a truly collaborative effort in which Colin Currie had considerable output. I caught up with both Simon Holt and Colin earlier today, and I began by asking Simon to tell me more about Uncle Ashworth.
He would shoot at neighbours' cats. He would shoot at just about anything. And there's a lovely photo of him with a brace of hairs over his arm. And he was very much a man of the country. There was kingfishers under glass in his front room and the heads of foxes on blocks on his wall, and whatever needed stuffing, he would stuff it.
And Colin, this tabletop, you're required to do quite a lot of physical work in this piece, aren't you?
I have on the tabletop a variety of sounds. Some of them are quite small. There's a very tiny, high-pitched chime, which is very difficult to hit in exactly the right place. It's quite tricky to operate, if you like. There's a log drum. There's the bottle, of course, which references ash. Wood blocks, a brake drum, various cymbals, but slightly strange-sounding cymbals, slightly trashy sounds. And then I have a variety of things which I play with my feet. Pedal cowbell, pedal klaxon, which is a real toad of toad hall thing. And then two hi-hat cymbals, which operate with my feet. I'm sitting on a cajon, which is a present from Simon. It's a lovely instrument.
It's a flamenco instrument. Uh-huh. It's like a drawer. Cajon means drawer in Spanish, and they sit on it. And it has guitar strings in it, so it rattles.
It's a lovely bass sound. It sounds fantastic. So it's my job to make these things sound decent, if you like, especially in the tabletop movement, where the idea is that we only really have three sounds at once, and I gradually move round and introduce a new sound one at a time, more or less. So the whole thing should sound quite integrated, quite organic. I'm extremely excited about the very first six beats of the piece because they're very sharp, very brittle, and they have a short silence after them. So that will be an amazing start to this piece. This tiny sort of fanfare, kick the piece off, followed by a couple of moments to hear it echo around the space. It's an enjoyable piece. Bits of it are quite witty, and there's moments of extreme
violence, right?
Yeah, violence and kind of madness, but
there's serene moments too. All sorts.
It does leave you something very special for the heart.
Colin Currie and Simon Holt talking to me earlier today. And here comes Colin Currie with tonight's conductor Thierry Fisher joining BBC National Orchestra of Wales for the London premiere of Simon Holt's A Table of Noises.
Thank you. Thank you.
A Table of Noises, written by Simon Holt, especially for tonight's soloist, the formidably talented Colin Curry. And given its London premiere here at the Proms by conductor Thierry Fisher and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, their leader, Leslie Hatfield. Warm hug of congratulations now between Simon Holt and Colin Curry. Fantastic warmth between the two of them. They worked, as we said, very closely together on this piece. Not so closely that Simon Holt was prepared to share everything, though. He told me earlier today that there are several figures from his past, long gone in reality, who hover around. Nobody knows who they are, not even Colin. Well, Simon Holt is composer in association with tonight's orchestra. His appointment began a couple of years ago. BBC National Orchestra of Wales premiered his work Troubled Light here at the Proms. That was also with Thierry Fisher. Since then, Simon's written a brand new work for the inauguration of the orchestra's new home in Cardiff, Hodnot Hall. Next season, a new double concerto on the cards. Centre Omaki, I believe it's called, the clarinet flugelhorn. That's going to be here on Radio 3 in November, performance on 3. Who knows, it may even end up one day at the Proms in due course, we hope. And a bow from Simon Holt, Colin Curry, and tonight's conductor, Thierry Fisher. Well, I have to say, I think it takes a brave composer to write as quietly as Simon Holt does for percussion. He told me earlier that he'd originally gone over to Colin Curry's house just to get a sense of what Colin could do, messing around with various instruments. He suddenly got the idea of writing almost an anti-percussion concerto, looking at the expressive possibilities of these instruments. It's not, Simon told me, about just bashing the percussion as loudly as possible. This piece is about finding a more atmospheric role for the soloist. So, finally on the bill this evening, music by Richard Strauss, his symphonic poem, Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks. Till is a chronic joker, a legendary mythic figure dating back to the 15th century. He turns up all over German folklore in a variety of different guises. In this version, Till is a visionary, a man who bucks conventions and trends in a bid to stand alone from the establishment. But he ends up paying the ultimate price for his heroism, and he's sentenced to death. The choice of story was very much a deliberate one. This was early in Strauss's career. His first opera, Guntram, had got, shall we say, less than favourable reviews. But this piece wasn't just a retort to the music critics. It was also an opportunity for Strauss to showcase and develop his brilliant abilities as an orchestrator. The writing is kaleidoscopic. There are effects that shift suddenly between different instrumental groups. It's almost a kind of mini concerto for orchestra. One of the most challenging parts is an opening flourish for solo horn. Well, earlier today, I caught up with Principal Horn of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Tim Thorpe. I asked him about the joys and the challenges of playing Strauss, particularly after a whole weekend of playing here at the Proms.
Yeah, a roast-up, I think we call it, really. We did Just Seven on Thursday, and then Doctor Who as well. Great fun to do, but again, very nice, you know, great for the brass, but it's constantly on your face, on top of Ride of the Valkyries and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, it's been fun, but yes, very tiring.
I wanted to talk to you particularly about Strauss.
It's a bit of a challenge. Can you just outline for us what the role in the piece is and why it's a tricky one?
Well, it's Eulenspiegel, he was a bit of a trickster. So I think the horn takes on the role, or certainly starts the role off, as being a bit cheeky and a bit naughty. It's in 6/8, but then it's not on the beat, so you never quite know where you're actually sort of, you know, starting. You can't tap along to it, really.
The opening of this piece, I understand, is a kind of test piece for horn players everywhere because it is so tricky. Is it the technical issues? Is it the intervals? Is it the... What is it about this particular extract that makes it challenging?
Well, you know, it's an audition favourite, really. It's always used in auditions anywhere you go, from college all the way through the profession. I suppose it's the range, because it starts in the middle of the range on the French horn and then goes fairly high and then finishes off fairly low as well.
It's just a real showpiece for the orchestra, this. I mean, you start them off and then everybody's sort of flying, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's got some great roles all over the place. I mean, one of my favourite bits is the E-flat clarinet bit at the end, because he just goes bonkers, really. It's very good fun to play, but hopefully we're all feeling fresh enough by then to do it.
Tim Thorpe, the principal horn with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, who will be playing that legendary solo in Till Eulenspiegel just a couple of minutes' time. And at the helm will be tonight's conductor, Thierry Fischer. What's the appeal of Strauss's score for him?
In general, in Strauss music, what I am very attracted to is this champagne feeling, you know, with different texture of sound everywhere, lots of actions, you know, the woodwind playing one action, the strings another one, an extreme character in the percussion. And, you know, really, one thing I think about when I think Richard Strauss is champagne, and especially this piece. You want, at the same time, to laugh a lot and cry 6 bars later, because the character of Till, you know, all this death sentence in the end and all the provocation, you know, with his horse and the cymbal and the schnarl, we say in German, and everything, you know, it's all provocation, and it goes through the music. It's very inspiring to conduct this different character, to go from one extreme character to another in a few seconds, and in the end it's absolutely dramatic. But.
And it's interesting that you say champagne, because it's that sense of fizz and energy that you always get in a Strauss score, but also that this composer loves making the orchestra work hard for their money. They have to be real virtuosi to play.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's extreme virtuose, Strauss in general, and this piece in particular, you know, so much. And it has to be played with virtuosity and delicacy, you know, because sometimes it's very soft. You have long lines taking from each other, starts in the low basses, you know, and goes up to the violin, piccolo taking over and everything. So you need at the same time full involvement without thinking and a lot of control of the orchestra technique.
With a piece like this, that's a well-known piece, an absolute core part of the repertoire, where does your performance start as a conductor? Where do you start with an interpretation?
First of all, especially conducting BBC Wales, which is an orchestra I know rather well, in a concert, I am trusting them a lot. And it's one of these pieces when you can say, okay, it's up to you guys, you know. And actually the job of conductor, the way I see it for such a piece, is to trust them, just giving a few indications and let the band, you know, go with madness. It's not the same if you do contemporary music like the whole concerto we played before, or Schumann, you know, or classical music. Well, a lot is about the energy of the conductor, you know, and the concept and the way you rehearse. But Richard Strauss and Till, you know, you can say, good luck, you know, let's enjoy. It's really a very different feeling than all the composers.
This orchestra has had to get to grips with an awful lot of music for these 4 days or so of performances at the Proms. Talk us through the range of what they've had to do and how it's gone.
I am full of admiration for the orchestra. I think that the 10 last days with the rehearsals in Cardiff, the orchestra played so many different pieces in a huge variety of repertoire, from Verdi Requiem to Doctor Who to Shostakovich, Schumann, Cherubini, Holst, Strauss, Prokofiev. I mean, absolutely unbelievable. And it was a very fruitful period for us. I mean, exhausting for the players, for concentration. But I mean, it shows the qualities of the band, you know, being able to go from, you know, extreme repertoire in so many pieces in a few days. And I think we are at the end today from a very, very busy period. That's why what I said about Strauss, it would be a good sibling just to let it go and just enjoy the 20 last minutes as much as we can as a group.
Thierry Fischer talking to me earlier today. So, Till Eulenspiegel, the piece opens with a kind of once upon a time introduction, and then we are off with Till's tongue-in-cheek musical motto. We heard Tim Thorpe talking about it earlier, that's the solo horn part. That theme pops up throughout the piece as Till embarks on his wild adventures. He argues with peasants, he rails at preachers, he tries and fails to woo a beautiful girl, and mocks the intelligentsia for that. Just read the music critics who've been terrible about his first opera. At the end, Till is brought before a panel of judges. They review his career, they sentence him to death. But even then, he can't resist departing from this world without a final cheeky wink. The whole thing ends up in a glorious blaze of colour. So here comes tonight's conductor, Thierry Fischer, to conduct his orchestra, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, in Till Eulenspiegel by Richard Strauss.
Thank you. Thank you.
Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks. The BBC National Orchestra of Wales under their principal conductor, Thierry Fisher. The leader, Leslie Hatfield. Well, this orchestra certainly has had to work hard recently. 10 days of relentless rehearsing, perfecting, performing. This is the fourth concert they've done here at the Proms since last Thursday. And they don't get much of a breather before they have to pack their bags and they are off for the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. Two dates there next week. Applause here at the Royal Albert Hall for E-flat clarinet John Cooper. All the winds and brass on their feet, indeed the strings too, and Thierry Fisher enjoying the warm applause here of the audience. Well, I'll be back here at the Proms on Friday. BBC 4 television as Mark Elder introduces the first of this summer's youth orchestras all the way from Australia. That prom also live here on Radio 3. But for now, from all of us here at the Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you on for the rest of this evening's listening to Jonathan Swain.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. Well, tonight's prom isn't the only live event tonight here on Radio 3. Later on, Jazz on 3 comes live from the Manchester Jazz Festival, including music by Stuart McCallum and a quartet featuring pianist Gwilym Simcock. That's live Jazz on 3 starting at 11:15 this evening. As for the Radio 3 mornings...
Breakfast on Radio 3. Breakfast on Radio 3, bringing music to life. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening, and in just over 5 minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview. Tonight, Norman Lebrecht talks to the American mezzo-soprano Marilyn Horne, tracing her career from a precocious Shirley Temple sound-alike to the major mezzo bel canto roles by Rossini, Bellini and Donizetti and others for which she was justly famed. That's at 9:15. Until then, music making from another mezzo, the Austrian Angelika Kirschlager. Here she is in songs by Korngold. Here it was Mahler recognised as something of a genius when Korngold was a mere 10 years old. And how like Mahler the first of these songs sounds. All of them Shakespeare settings. And Angelika Kirschlager here with pianist Helmut Deutsch.
Thank you.
Hey Robin, ending those four of the Songs of the Clown, Opus 29, by Korngold. All of them Shakespeare settings from the late 1930s, and they were sung there by Angelika Kirschlager with pianist Helmut Deutsch. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 9:15. Time now for the second in a new series of the Lebrecht interview with Norman Lebrecht.
Marilyn Horne is an American pioneer, a pathbreaker for American singers on European opera stages. From her 1960 debut in the stark role of Marie in Alban Berg's Wozzeck, Horne became the mezzo of choice in roles that ranged from the ultramodern to the baroque to bel canto, with a strong preference for Rossini. Igor Stravinsky was one of her mentors, and her strongest stage partnership was with Joan Sutherland. Opera News, magazine of the Met, has called her possibly the most influential singer in American history. Behind the public figure is a woman of courage and resilience. Raised in the Great Depression and known as Jackie for her tomboy demeanor, she married, against great social pressure, a black musician, Henry Lewis, who became a successful conductor. Since retiring from the stage in 1996, she's run the Marilyn Horne Foundation, which gives recital and other opportunities to rising singers, among them Nicole Cabell and Lawrence Brownlee. The song, she likes to say, continues. Marilyn Horne, Jackie, you've still got a busier diary than most active singers. What drives you to keep working for people who want to sing?
I keep asking myself that. I'm not quite sure. It must be that I enjoy it, and I certainly enjoy being able to aid and abet young singers, help them along. I really like teaching very, very much, and because I do have so many contacts and friends in the world, I'm able to also help them in many other ways, pick up the phone and call somebody and maybe just say, so-and-so is auditioning for you today or tomorrow. Open up your ears, especially for this singer, because I think this singer is special. People call me and ask me if I could please cast their next Beethoven Ninth or Mozart Requiem or something like that, which I'm always delighted to do, because I have a long list of singers who've passed my way that I just, have a great joy to recommend.
This informal, extracurricular, extramural activity that you take on, the masterclasses, the academies, the foundation, all of that, is that to fill a gap that you feel has opened out?
I'm not really sure because I just sort of fell into all of it. I didn't really have a plan, to tell you the truth. I had not thought too much about teaching. In fact, I didn't even know if I could teach. Some friends have said to me, well, you're crazy. You've been teaching always, because say in a rehearsal, a young singer might be singing and I would walk up and say, why are you singing that like that? Or something lovely, you know? So when I was asked to take over the voice department duties at the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara, where I also went to school when I was 19, I said yes, and that just started the whole ball rolling. And then I just began to get asked to teach in many places. So what I'm ending up doing basically is traveling a lot, and I go to various music schools in universities or private and spend maybe a week teaching a residency, shall we say, where I teach master classes, some closed to only the students, some open to the public, and then lots of private lessons.
You must have a bigger Rolodex of young singers than the director of any opera house.
I really do.
You had voice training at 8 years old.
Oh, actually, earlier. I had started my first formal lessons at 5, which, of course, I don't recommend for anybody. But in my more mature years, I realized what it was all about. It was because of Shirley Temple. She was the big star of the movies in the Depression. And there was this little 3-year-old girl singing and dancing. And they didn't think anything about the fact that I could maybe do that too, since I obviously showed evidence of being able to sing very, very early.
And your parents thought you could end up as the next child sensation?
I think perhaps that might have been behind it. I wasn't, though.
But the family went to California, which is where stars are made.
Right.
Did they think you were going to be a movie star? Did you think you were going to be a movie star?
Never. They may have, but they didn't say it to me.
But you were also doing doo-wahs for Hollywood soundtracks.
But that happened when I was about 12. We started doing a lot of background music for the movies.
And the kids around you, the other people who are doing it, they probably all had their eyes set on the movies, whereas you were already focused on music?
I'm not sure. To tell you the truth, everybody was pretty much focused on singing. I can tell you that working in the movies was a marvelous way to earn money. That's one of the things that was a big attraction.
Was it also a marvelous way to learn music? There were a lot of really interesting people around.
Yes, there were. And I'm very fortunate that I had that experience. You know, now there are many books coming out about those years in Los Angeles where we had all basically the refugees from Hitler. Not necessarily in the movies, but there were a lot of wonderful people who worked in the movies, mostly men, of course, in the music end of it, the composing end of it. And I also had many teachers and coaches who had that same experience of coming from Europe.
Do you remember that also at school, that there were kids in your class who were perhaps refugees in the same ways that you'd been displaced?
Not so many. I can tell you what I definitely remember, because I lived in Long Beach, which is 16, 17 miles from the center of L.A. And what we had, which was fascinating because we moved there just after the whole war was over, we had all of the Japanese students being released from the internment camps. That was very interesting. I didn't really realize how interesting it was at the time, but I definitely remember we had all of these students.
These were Japanese Americans?
Absolutely, yeah.
And they'd spent the war locked up?
The Japanese were interned in California during the war, and they came out and came to our schools. And we interacted, you know, like any other students. It was just fine. But that was interesting, you know, because I came from this small town in Pennsylvania that basically immigrants were there, but they were Italians or Polish or something like that. I hadn't experienced, first of all, almost zero blacks and Hispanics, forget that. We didn't have those either. And there was not a Japanese family that I know existed in that small town, about 10,000 people.
You were a product of the Californian melting pot.
I was, yes.
And you made what you now call pirate recordings, which are cover versions of pop hits.
Right.
You were imitating Peggy Lee in Yes. Lover When I'm Near You.
Yes, that's right. That was, again, all for money. Mm-hmm. By then, I was in university. I went to University of Southern California. And a friend of mine who was singing with me in a cappella choir and madrigal singer said, you know, I'm making these recordings and we could use you to be in the, I guess, backup music, you'd say, for $40 a session. That was a lot of money in 1951. So, again, it was a money deal. And I relied on my mimicry because I very quickly went from being backup music to being one of the soloists. And I have good ears for mimicking and I used it. What can I tell you?
Did you never think this might be the easier option? Forget about opera. Why don't I go into becoming a pop singer? Why don't I become Lena Horne?
Our dear Lena, she just died.
Yeah.
Isn't that, I'm so sad. She was somebody that I greatly admired and I knew somewhat. Yeah, I'm sad that she's gone. She was a great, great artist.
She came to your first Carmen at the Met, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She certainly did. And I remember so many wonderful evenings hearing her in nightclubs and, you know, I guess one would call it cabaret now, mainly, and her incredible one-woman show on Broadway that was just staggering. But in any event, I did dabble with pop music because I could sing it. You know, the pop music of our day was singable. It's not like today's. And therefore, I did a lot of it. And yeah, I could have swung either way, but the music of classical music was definitely pulling me. That's, I think, what it was all about in the end, having the talent, but then also being able to live with all that great music.
The first Carmen you sang was voice track in the movie Carmen Jones.
That's right.
With Dorothy Dandridge and Harry Belafonte.
Right.
Did you think that was a good idea, turning grand opera into soap and pop?
I thought it was fine. You know, I thought it was fine. Also, if you ever make a study, Norman, of the lyrics that Hammerstein wrote, they're ingenious.
I saw it at 16. I was bowled over. I hadn't seen a Carmen in the opera house. I thought it was great.
You saw the movie?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I was 20 when I did it. Again, it was this thing of making money. I was at university and I needed every dollar I could get to pay for my lessons and everything else. And a friend of mine said, they're hiring white people to sing in the soundtrack and we can make a lot of money. And I said, great, I'm going to go audition. And so I called and got an audition. But unfortunately, or fortunately, they sent me to the wrong audition. They sent me to the audition where people were auditioning to be the singers, to dub the voices of the actors. And I sang Micaela Zarya in French. That was my audition piece. But again, I was sitting there listening to the other ladies sing, and they were, a lot of them singing the Hammerstein version of the Habanera. And I've never been shy about putting myself forward. I just said, you know, I can sing low too. And the wonderful conductor, Herschel Gilbert, said to me, would you like to sing the Habanera? And I said, well, I've never sung it, but I know it for sure. And he said, can you just read the Hammerstein lyrics? I said, sure. And that was that. And within very short order, they asked me to come in the next day, I think it was, and do a little more singing for the role of Carmen. That was a surprise, though. I didn't expect that.
In college, you met the Vienna legend Lotte Lehmann, and a philanthropist paid her to give you lessons. Was she rough on you?
Not in the beginning. I think my first gig with her was a master class at USC, and I remember I sang my very first German Lied. I was 17, and it was Die junge Nonne of Schubert. And she was fine, and I did more classes with her. Later on, when I was at the Music Academy in Santa Barbara with her, she let fly on me one day. And
what did she say?
Well, she just really badly criticized my German, and I'm sure that it needed criticizing, but not in the way she did it. And I learned a lesson that day. I didn't think about it at the time, to tell you the truth, but somewhere the seed was planted that if I ever did public master classes, I would never be that hard on a student in public.
She told you also that if you want to be an opera singer, you don't have children.
Oh, yes, that was another time, yes. And that was, I was already pregnant. She could be a tough lady, there's no question about that. She heard somebody say, Jackie, I hear you're pregnant. And I wasn't showing, I guess, too much at that time. I said, yes. And she turned around and this other person said, what do you want, a boy or a girl? And I said, I don't care. I want a healthy baby. And she said, and I am not exaggerating this, she said, well, I hope it'll be a Null. And she said, spoke to me in German. And we know that Null means nothing because singers shouldn't have children. Well, I can tell her, wherever she is, she was wrong. Because also, you have a wonderful baby and child and grown up, and then you have grandchildren, which is the glory of your old age.
While we're on memory lane, Jackie, how did you get to meet Stravinsky?
We have a wonderful organization in Los Angeles. It was originally called Evenings on the Roof and then became known as the Monday Evening Concerts, where basically new music and really old music were the foundation of these concerts.
You were singing madrigals.
Madrigals and also solos, absolutely, soloists, yeah. Mm-hmm. By then, you see, it was in my late teens, and I was beginning to be known as a dependable singer around town in Los Angeles. So I was being called to come and sing lots of concerts. So that's how it happened. And this particular one was the music of Stravinsky. And I worked it with him. And he actually taught me my very first Russian. They were some Russian folk songs of his. And the relationship grew from then. And then I worked very closely with his assistant at the time, Robert Kraft. We did lots of Gesualdo madrigals. I lay claim to having recorded 65 Gesualdo madrigals and motets. And also things like the Monteverdi Vespers, singing that. That was a big deal because I don't think it had ever been performed in Los Angeles. That was the kind of rep that we did in those concerts.
Isn't there something that Stravinsky said about you? He said, the good Lord knows everything, but Jackie knows better.
I don't think he said that, but, you know, it got quoted. You know, I always remember with John Huston, and he said, whether you should do the legend or you should do what's true. And he said, go with the legend every time.
There was also a story that you told Hindemith that he didn't understand Baroque style.
I don't think I ever did that. I remember it was fun. I was asked to sing with him at the first time in Vienna, and we got to know each other. And Gesualdo was one of the first things that I did with him. And he was amazed to find out that I already knew the madrigals. And then we talked about another piece of Monteverdi's, and he said that he wanted to do that, which I did with him in concert. And I said, I've already sung this. And he was just, where did you do all of this? I said, at the University of Southern California.
And he couldn't believe that an American, let alone a Californian, could do these things.
I think that was probably part of it, but the fact that I was up front and cheeky enough to say, but I know these songs already.
It was Stravinsky's assistant, Robert Kraft, who helped you go to Europe after your father died in 1956.
Well, no, that's not quite accurate either. Okay. Sorry to...
No. Keep correcting the legend.
I got myself to Europe. That was... Okay. I had decided before my father died, actually, because he died suddenly, I had already decided that that was going to be my road. Now, we're talking about 1956, and the German opera houses were very, very interesting to aspire to in those days because of the fact there were so many of them and we didn't have them in the United States. You know, in those days, we just barely had some regional companies in the United States. It was very different. So if you really wanted to get your opera legs from the ground up, you really sort of had to go there. And again, I had all these teachers who had come out of that system and recommended it very, very highly to me. And as a matter of fact, at the time, I was offered a contract to go to the New York City Opera, and I turned it down because I guess I had been brainwashed enough, or I, you know, actually did have some smarts and thought this would be the better route for me. I never, ever regretted it. It was really the best kind of experience anyone can get.
And you did 4 years hard ground in provincial Gelsenkirchen.
I did 3 years there. I did a year studying in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hard grind. But again, you know, if you're enjoying what you're doing, that makes it much less hard.
And in 1960, you make the breakthrough as Marie in Wozzeck. That's a pretty dangerous role to go with. Tough on you, tough on the audience.
You know,
None of the German girls in the house was prepared to put their hands up and say, we'll do it?
Well, I don't think they were asked to. You know, you were assigned what you were supposed to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were under a fest contract like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned Marie, and I actually was terrified of it because one always had heard this kind of thing is a voice breaker. And I had sung enough of Schoenberg and Webern and that kind of music with Robert Kraft and other people in Los Angeles that I knew how difficult it was. I do not have absolute pitch, and that is a liability, actually, when you're going to sing 12-tone music, but I had been experienced in it. And at the time, I told my music director that I didn't want to do it because I thought it was a voice breaker, as we say, and he was quite insistent. I don't think we argued or anything, but I made him a deal. I don't even know if it would have held up, but I said, I'll learn the first scene. And if I feel that I can sing it without killing myself, I'll do it. My agent in Vienna told me if I did it, he wouldn't manage me anymore. A lot of people said, you're too young, you're too blah, blah, blah.
You were 25.
You know? I was 26 at the time.
Okay.
I learned that first scene and I thought, well, this feels pretty good. This doesn't seem to tax me beyond my vocal resources, and started to learn the rest of it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. I went against a lot of heavy tide, but I felt somehow that it was just really right for me. And boy, was I right.
From the age of 17, you'd been seeing Henry Lewis on and off. He was a double bass player in the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was a year older than you. And nobody wanted you to marry him because he was black. What was it your mother said? She said, go and be his mistress, don't marry him.
Oh, right, yes, absolutely. She did say that, which is quite astounding for somebody like my mother who came out of a white-bred small town in Pennsylvania, Protestant ethic, the whole thing, to even consider that someone should live in sin rather than be married.
And Roger Wagner, your chorus director, said if you married a black man, you were finished in America.
That's right. He did. That my career would be over. I hate the word career, but I can't think of a better one. I had a lot of lovely advice like that, but they were all wrong. It's amazing.
You must have been pretty sure of yourself.
Oh, yes.
To resist all of that.
Sure, but also unsure. That's what was difficult, was going ahead with what I really wanted to do in marrying Henry, but feeling all of those doubting voices in my head. That was not easy. That gave me some unsteady moments, but he was the object of my affections.
Were you prepared for the prejudice that you'd face afterwards, the looks that you got, perhaps in the southern states, places you couldn't go together?
We didn't go there together.
Just didn't go.
No. I'm not even sure that we did that as a rule. It was a question that I was basically only going to the southern states to sing recitals, and that was by myself with my accompanist. So we weren't in those places. I was prepared, yes. I expected it, and it was never really as bad as I expected, and I think that's because we were in showbiz, and showbiz people are generally much more open-minded to anything that's controversial. So that made it a lot easier. And my mother came around after a couple of weeks. She realized that she had made a very big mistake by not attending our wedding, and apologized to me and said it was a big mistake, the whole, you know, for on her part. But, you know, I understood her. She thought her world was also going to come crashing around her. And that was that.
And Henry Lewis's career took off pretty much at the same time as yours.
Right, right. He, you know, he had gone into the Los Angeles Philharmonic as a player when he was only 16. And that was already a tremendously big deal. He was like what we would say the Jackie Robinson of classical music, because there wasn't another black player in a major symphony in the United States at that time.
Wow. That's the sort of thing that we forget. He was the first black player in any American symphony orchestra.
That's right.
And then Zubin Mehta made him assistant conductor.
Yeah, that's right. Zubin was made the music director after there was a debacle with George Schulte.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? Did you ever hear about
it?
Yeah. And
heard it from Schulte. He turned up. He'd found they'd made another appointment without consulting him, and he got on the first flight home.
Right. I'll never forget one night. Several years later, many years later, actually, I had just done a concert with Zubin with the Philharmonic. By the way, Zubin is somebody I totally adore and have for 50 years. And afterwards, there was a party, a small dinner party, and we were sitting around this table. And the woman who did all the hiring and firing in those days was a lady named Dorothy Chandler, whose husband owned the Los Angeles Times. And she's the one who hired Zubin as George's associate conductor. And we were speaking about the fact that she'd very much liked astrology, and she followed Carol Reiter, that was his name. And she said, that's where I saw that I should hire Zubin as Schulte's assistant. And I said, my mouth sometimes gets the better of me, and I said, better you should have consulted Schulte.
And then he went on to turn the New Jersey Symphony into a top flight orchestra.
Yeah.
When he was music director in New Jersey, it can't have been easy for you, being a conductor's wife as well as a famous singer, having to do the chores of greeting the patrons, attending the premieres.
Well, I did the best I could. I probably didn't do as well as I could, because most of my observances have shown me over my long life now is that conductors really need their wives to be sort of secretary and nurse and dresser and assistant and all kinds of things like that. So I was not able to fill those roles very well. I was dealing with my own career, and as you can imagine, you have to put an awful lot of time and preparation in when you reach a certain level.
Was that one of the problems that contributed to the ending of the marriage? That you were going in those different directions?
It could have been a bit of it. One thing I can tell you, it never had to do with race, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, we just grew apart like a lot of marriages do. But we remained very, very good friends. And we had a daughter. And you have to do that when you have a child. Not everybody does. I do know that. But we were able to. And we used to joke that we had a failed divorce.
After you had your daughter, was it then that the voice dropped from High Marie to Middle Range Rossini?
Not really. It's just that it seemed like I was getting into a repertory that nobody else could sing. Enjoying it very, very much. And I think that, again, this fate, destino, whatever you want to call it, stepped in because I was asked to audition to sing with Joan.
Joan Sutherland.
Right, of course. And it became obvious that there was a lot of repertory that she was performing that I could probably do the other part. And we just sort of calculated in a way that maybe this is where I belong. Maybe this is what I was meant to do. I do think that my voice was settling a little bit, but this was also nothing new. Since the time I was about 15 or 16, people would hear my voice and they'd say, are you sure you're not a mezzo? And I'd say, oh, no, I'm a soprano. Because I had an easy top and I had had it, since I was a child, and I didn't think twice about it. But I was involved in singing a lot of mezzo music, but it just was crazy time, It was just me sort of singing everything. I had some kind of smarts with knowing what I should not sing, but singing lower music was not one of them. But remember, I was not singing Azucena, and I was not singing Amneris. I wasn't singing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was singing Nigra Sum in the Monteverdi Vespers.
In years to come, quizmasters will ask which American mezzo-soprano sang with Judy Garland but never with Maria Callas. There's only going to be one answer, isn't there?
Well, we were at a party one night and ended up in a room that was all red, ceiling, carpet, bedspreads, everything, sitting in the middle of the floor singing together. You know, it was fun. I was a little tipsy. I don't think she was, but I was. And so I was able to just sit there and enjoy it all.
And what were you singing?
She was making up a song. She was singing Louis B, Louis C, Louis D, Louis E, Louis F, Louis G. I think she meant Louis B. Mayer, but and then we went on to singing other pop songs together.
You were a huge admirer of Callas, but you never sang with her.
No, I never did. I really missed my opportunity. I listened to an agent that I had at the time, who I had a lot of recitals booked in not very important places, but places in the United States. And I was asked if I would come and sing Adalgisa with her in Paris, her last Norma's. My agent said, oh, you can't do that. You're booked. I was very stupid. I should have swum the Atlantic to do that. But I listened to my agent and fulfilled my engagements.
How different was she, do you think, from Joan Sutherland? You knew how easily you could work with Joan.
I'm going to throw that back at you.
Go on.
How different do you think they were, Norman?
Oh, chalk and cheese, obviously. Obviously. But, I mean, you'd settled into that pattern of working with a fellow Anglophone who was Joan Sutherland, who was of even temperament, whereas with Callas it would have been much more exciting.
Well, I think I was definitely drawn to that aspect of Callas, for sure, to you know, really get into the words, and especially in the recitatives are so terribly important for me, and they were, I think, for Callas too, maybe a little less for Joan. I wouldn't like to say that, but it's possible. And I liked very much her temperament, and yeah, you know, we know she had her vocal flaws, but she was... what do I have to... Come on, the world knows who Callas was.
Which of the men did you enjoy working with?
Come on, I loved singing with Luciano.
Sure.
What's not to love, right?
I was just going to say, I just saw on YouTube a clip of you singing Verdi Requiem in Milano with Abbado, must have been about 1970, and Luciano, very young.
Right.
Sitting behind you and looking up at you in frank amazement.
Really?
Absolutely wonderful, yeah.
I must watch that. Well, Luciano, you know, that was something else. I don't have to talk about him either. Everybody knows what it was. But I have to say, for my own self, I get a catch in my throat when I hear his voice on the radio or on discs or YouTube. The sound of that voice, it makes me very sad still. And to think that we shared the same disease, that also, you know, at the end of his life, we were not only sharing music, but we were sharing pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. Just coming back to La Scala, you had a celebrated moment there with Beverly Sills when there were two Americans who were going on stage, and as far as you saw it, there was only going to be one.
Well, it was just a question of the machinations that were taking place with her press team. And the people at La Scala were very kind and nice to me. And I'd already been there because I made my actual debut in Oedipus Rex, which I thought was kind of fun to make my debut there in one of the great works of Stravinsky. Mm-hmm. And then went on to sing The Siege of Corinth of Rossini, and Beverly was part of the cast. But the Scala people said her press agent is coming up to the press room where all the pictures and things are, and choosing everything that's going to the periodicals like New York Times and Time Magazine, etc., etc., and he's leaving you out. And I couldn't take that.
So what did
I
you do?
I just went into her dressing room very shortly before the curtain opened and told him that if my picture did not appear in the New York Times, I would come to his office and smash him in the face. That was the opening. But it had to do with machinations, as I said, which were going on behind the scenes. That's all. But, you know, Beverly was seizing her moment to become a super duper pooper star. And that's the way it goes in this profession. But I did not want to be pushed against the wall.
I think you said at the time a singer has to look after herself.
I think that's pretty much it, and it still holds.
Did conductors give you much trouble?
Occasionally, oh yes, especially with the Rossini. The mm-hmm. Rossini was very difficult because the conductors did not want to, at that time, allow any kind of ornaments and embellishments to the music, which of course, with Richard Bonning and with Henry and myself and Joan, we had all done a lot of research on this, and we knew that the performance practices in the days of Rossini was quite different, that the reason why those cavatinas and cavalettas were written twice was the second time you better come around and show off what you can do. And so there, I had a lot of trouble with this. It seemed to always, you know.
Anyone in particular?
Well, even down to Abbado, whom I absolutely adored, and we'd sung quite a bit together, and I had problems with the conductor at the Met. His name is Gabor Utrich. He was hired to do the new production of Italiana there, and I started to rehearse, and he was fairly insulting, and I just said, you know what, I don't think we're going to be able to do this together, and I just closed my book and said goodbye. I walked out, which, having had this happen already several times, I was prepared with a contract that said, the version, that's how we put it, the version will be in agreement with Miss Horn. And at that time, we had for a very short time, Raphael Kubelik was our general music director, and he was the one that chose Maestro Utrich to conduct the opera. And it came down to reading the contract, basically. And I'll never forget when he came in opening night to me and said, well, you see, everything works out. Everything's going to be peace and love and light and all of that. I said, yeah, but it would not have been without that contract. Okay. And, you know, you get a little jaded about things like that, but you are prepared. So I'm switching.
So you walked out and you walked back in. You said you'd do it my way.
Yeah, I don't think I used those words, but I was certainly adamant that I did it my way or the highway. And then I'll fast forward to La Scala when I went to sing it there. They already had had a very successful production there with Berganza in the role of Isabella in Italiana. And because Claudio and I shared the same management, he didn't feel comfortable with putting that clause in the contract for La Scala. And I said, oh, God, here we go again. But I let it go because I had sung with Abbado, Oedipus Rex, and done concerts with him and things like Mahler and evenings with other music. But I went to the first of all, I took great pains to copy all of my embellishments and send them to him, so that he would know exactly what he was dealing with. Well, you know, we sat in a rehearsal, and everybody else was present, and I knew that the eyes were on me, the American singer. It always was that way when you were very much the foreigner in those days. And, oh, well, here were the comments. I don't like that. No, you shouldn't do that. And I just stopped. I said, you know what, Claudio? I do think that you and I should be alone first before we rehearse the rest of the opera. Again, he didn't want to do it. And I said, I sent you all of my ornaments and embellishments. And he just started striking them out. And I said, you know what? I don't want to do it if I can't do it in a way that I've really worked it out and think is correct. So I went again to a hotel room and said, I'm out of here on the first plane tomorrow morning. And the flowers started to arrive from the sovrintendente and from various other people. And Claudio said, okay. And we had wonderful performances. Of course, the great thing was the reviews that came out that said, up to now we've had Mozart, now we have Rossini.
How did you get on with Leonard Bernstein?
Very well, very well. You know, there's a certain thing about coming from the same land and understanding sort of deep down what it's all about to be an American in this case. And I think that we shared too. But Lenny always used to say to me, and I take this as a great, great compliment, that Lenny said, you do things musically before I tell you to do them. I think of it and you've already done it, that kind of thing. And he had such great ability to teach also and to instruct. And you couldn't have a meal with Lenny without learning something. It was a wonderful, great, great collaboration.
The foundation that you've set up has presented more than 100 new singers and reached 50,000 children across the United States. What are you aiming for? What's the goal?
Well, the first aim was for me when I decided to set up the foundation. I was facing my 60th birthday, and I said, you know, I think it's time for me to start giving back big time because I've had such a wonderful life in music. I decided that the place that I saw where it was needed was recitals because they were becoming fewer and far between in the United States.
So you're trying to fix a broken infrastructure?
Yeah, I've tried. Trying very, very hard. What I succeeded in doing, I think, was creating a foundation that got a very fine reputation for doing really, really good, solid work and becoming quite well known throughout the country for people who loved recitals, wanted to sing recitals. And I created a real interest for lots of young singers. I do know that they wanted very much to be a part of it. But what has happened is we are now being absorbed into Carnegie Hall and will no longer be the Marilyn Horne Foundation. We will be the Marilyn Horne Legacy at Carnegie Hall, and we are going to be a part of their Weill Institute, which is for children's concerts, local recitals. We didn't just perform for children. That was part of the outreach. We were there really performing for the public, and we had these residencies in various cities throughout the country. We were the only foundation that was dedicated only to singing.
Is it harder for young singers, young American singers today, than it was when you were growing up in the Great Depression?
I think it's more difficult in many, many ways because of certain other requirements. And now we are dealing with HD, and that is making an enormous change in opera. Look, I happen to think that television ruined our lives, basically. And now we have the internet. It's just like a monster there in front of us. And YouTube and people have so much...
So how does opera and singing survive in this environment?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I'm really... The way it's going to survive is that there will always be voices coming along who want to sing it. That's for sure. And I hear them all the time. I'm constantly hearing auditions, especially for my school in Santa Barbara. We listened live to 573 singers this year to take 23 places. So I hear the voices coming all the time. But the question is how they're going to be used. I don't have to go into, you know, you write about this all the time anyway, you know, the kinds of productions that they're being asked to perform in and the kinds of physical attributes that are now becoming quite necessary because HD has really come on so strong. And I have many friends who live in different cities that love it. They wouldn't miss one of those broadcasts.
All they want to see is opera on television, but not in the opera house anymore because they can't see it live enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, I happen to go to the Met a lot, first of all, because I live in New York, but I also live a block from where the Met is. So I go there and hear lots of things. And I must say, a lot of the things that are very successful on HD are not so successful in the live performances. They're very different. A lot of people you can't hear very well. And that's the thing that's disturbing me the most.
And I've seen directors who watched their first night performances from the television truck outside rather than from the house.
Absolutely, no question about it.
How do you tell singers to contend with this? They can't have a Marilyn Horne clause in their contract anymore. How do they resist these onslaughts on their integrity?
Well, I tell you, they have to do what I did before I could get a clause, right? You have to figure out how you can survive in the situation. Maybe they have to do some dumb things on stage, but they'll have to do it until they get some modicum of control. You know, well, I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, or I won't do that. Not everybody gets the control. We know that, too. But I have to still, in my position as a teacher and as certainly a promoter and helper of young singers, I have to still teach them in the way that I was brought up, to get their voices having a wonderful technique that will sail out in the hall, whatever size it is. I have to still teach that. I can't teach while you're going to be on a microphone. I have to go for the straight old singing principles. You can call it bel canto if you want to, how the 19th century singers were trained. I do have to go for that.
You've had a real struggle with pancreatic cancer.
I did.
And you faced it as you faced everything openly with great transparency.
I was very lucky that Guardian Angel was around again. I just really have done great. It's been 4.5 years since I was diagnosed, and I just knock on wood every day, but I'm still here.
Marilyn Horne, thank you very much.
Norman, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Marilyn Horne was talking to Norman Lebrecht. And don't forget the programme's available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download it as a podcast at bbc.co.uk/podcasts. Well, next Monday evening at the later time of 9:45, Norman Lebrecht will be in conversation with the conductor Simone Young. That's next Monday evening, 9:45, here on BBC Radio 3.
A celebration of the genius of Stephen Sondheim. An amazing cast perform songs from some of his best-loved shows with the BBC Concert Orchestra and conductor David Charles Abell.
Well, Stephen Sondheim creates a unique sound world for each of his musicals. I mean, for Little Night Music, it's the world of the Viennese Waltz. For Sweeney Todd, it's sort of shock horror movie music. And for Company, it's 70s contemporary sound. It's going to be a joy to create all those worlds with the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is the ideal instrument to do all those different styles.
Sondheim at 80 in the BBC Proms, Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to tonight, and Jazz on 3 tonight comes live from the Manchester Jazz Festival, including music by Stuart McCallum and a quartet featuring pianist Gwilym Simcock. That's live Jazz on 3, starting at 11:15 this evening. Before it at 11, the start of a new week of the essay. Music might feature in the work of a good many writers, but do that many writers actually play an instrument? More than you might think. And this week's essay series charts 5 writers with musical careers, so to speak, and how playing relates to their lives as writers. They're also keen to demonstrate their musical talents, which you can hear at the end of each essay. Novelist Patrick Gale begins the series tonight with his recollections.